Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we all have as believers, and that is to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Ehud, the second judge. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thank you, Bob. In the book of Judges, in chapter 3, we start reading about the various judges. And we said there's 12 judges in the book of Judges. And last time we looked at our first one, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who was the first judge in Israel. But now we are up to the second judge, Ehud. Now in Judges 3 and verse 12 we read, "And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord." So the sons of Israel, they again did evil, and this is the evil before Jehovah. And the evil, as we discussed before, was idolatry. That was the evil, the calamity-causing thing that Israel did so many times, which was contrary to their covenant with the Lord. So the Lord raised up another enemy for them, and this time it was Eglon, which means calf-like. And he was the king of Moab. Now, Moab means from a father. And Moab, if we'd go back to the book of Genesis, he was Lot's oldest daughter's son. And remember, Lot's daughters had gotten him drunk and committed incest with him and gotten pregnant from their father. So through this gross incest, were born Moab, and they actually seemed to celebrate the incest because she called her son from a father, Moab. Now, Moab was descended from Lot, Abraham's nephew, and he grew into a nation that was a neighbor on the borders of Israel to the east. And so this king of Moab, Eglon, becomes Israel's next enemy who suppresses them. Verse 13, "Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel, and took possession of the city of palms." So he gathers two nations to ally with him. One is Ammon. Ammon means tribal. And the man Ammon was actually the son of Lot's youngest daughter, again named tribal, almost celebrating her incest. And Ammon grew into another nation. They were the neighbors of Israel to the northeast. And he also allied with Amalek. Amalek was one of the wicked Canaanite nations. And so these three nations together, they defeat Israel with Eglon as their leader. Now he takes possession of the city of palm trees, which we learn from Deuteronomy 34 and verse 3 was another name for Jericho, where it says, "The south and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar." So Jericho was the city of palm trees. And Eglon captures it, and he takes possession and rules over Israel. Verse 14, "So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. So the sons of Israel are forced into an 18-year servitude. Now we've talked about the fact that these years of servitude add up to 93 years, and that makes the difference between the numbers in 2 Kings and the numbers Paul gives in the book of Acts. And so we had 8 years before Othniel, and now we have another 18 years, so we add this to the 8 years of verse 8, and we get 26 years of servitude so far. Verse 15, "But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab." So the Lord has pity on Israel, and again, this is that cycle of judges that we talked about several weeks ago, that they would turn from the Lord and worship idols. The Lord would give them into the oppressive hand of one of the nations around them, who would conquer them and rule over them. They would cry out to the Lord, and he'd have pity on them, and he'd raise up a judge who would deliver them, and then judge them, and they would be safe all the years of that judge's judgeship. So this is the next judge, and his name is Ehud, which means united. He is a son of Gera, which means a grain. And he is a Benjamite, one of the tribe of Benjamin, one of the two tribes from Rachel, Israel's favorite wife, along with Joseph. And Benjamin was Jerusalem, although Benjamin bordered on Judah and seems to have been dominated by Judah. So this Ehud is chosen as the next judge. Now he is said to be left-handed, which is, of course, unusual. At least 90% of people are right-handed. But the idea here, though, seems to be more than that he was a lefty, like we would say. But it actually seems to indicate that he was injured in his right hand, so he had no choice. The Hebrew is impeded in his right, or in his right hand. Now, why this was, it doesn't say. Whether he was born with some kind of defect in his right hand, or whether he had been working and some kind of accident had happened, he'd injured his right hand and it was now damaged, couldn't be used normally. Or whether it was in some kind of battle, he had been wounded in his right hand and his right hand was therefore damaged and crippled. I don't know, but he had to use his left hand because his right hand was hindered, it was crippled. Verse 16, now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, and fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. So Ehud carries a dagger. He makes it for himself. Or we might say it was a short sword, because a cubit is about 18 inches, and that would be awfully long for a dagger. We think of a dagger as being more like 12 inches or maybe less. But this was an 18-inch long short sword or dagger. And he conceals it in his clothes on his right thigh. Now understand, a right-handed person, which is the typical person, is right-handed. He would naturally want to draw his weapon from the left side. And that would be the usual place for a weapon. Now that might seem strange to you, but you've probably never tried to put on a sword. If even when you're a kid you tried to wear a toy sword, where would you want to put it on? Well, if you're right-handed, for ease of drawing, if you practice drawing it very much, you probably would have found that the place to put it is on your left thigh. Because then you reach over across yourself and you pull it out. And it's very easy to pull out. Whereas if you want to reach back to your right thigh, you have to turn your hand around and kind of bend your wrist and reach awkwardly to try to pull it out. Now, that's not where you want it as a right-hander. You want it on your left side. So the left thigh is probably where the vast majority of people would arm themselves. And you wouldn't expect a weapon on the right side. Now, of course, Ehud was crippled in his right hand, so he'd want to use his left. And the perfect place for a left-handed person to have his weapon is on the right. So Ehud puts this dagger or short sword on his right-hand side, hides it in his clothes. Now, they might well have checked him for weapons on his left side, but not expected a weapon on his right side, so not examined it there. Because, again, a right-handed person would have a lot of trouble getting a weapon out from the right-hand side. And it would be very awkward, and you wouldn't want to do it that way, so they wouldn't expect to check the right-hand side. Verse 17, so he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. So Ehud, it seems, is sent, or he gets himself sent somehow, with Israel's tribute money to Eglon. Now, Israel were the slaves of Moab, and they were forced to pay tribute money to Moab as Moab's slaves. And it seems that Ehud is the one who's sent with the tribute. Now, we also learn in this verse that Eglon is a very fat man. And that would have been quite unusual in that time, mostly because food was hard to get. And getting fat, you'd have to be very wealthy to have enough food in order to get fat. You know, nowadays, often what we call, anyway, the poor are fat. It shows that they aren't really very poor at all if they're fat. But the reality is that when you're poor, when you're really poor, you can't really afford to be fat. And so back then, to be fat was unusual, and it usually meant a lot of wealth. Verse 18. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. So Ehud brings the tribute, and then they're leaving, but he tells his, probably his fellow Israelites or his servants, who had carried the tribute for him, yeah, you go away. I have something else to do. You go, leave me alone. So he sends them off so they can't be implicated. Verse 19, but he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. He said, keep silence. And all who attended him went out from him. So Ehud turns from the stone images. And the idea here is of graven images, probably idols. Probably Moabite idols that have been set up, or maybe these are some of the guilty Israelite idols that had caused the Lord to give them to Moab. These were by Gilgal, which means rolling, and was where the Israelites had circumcised themselves after their wilderness wanderings under Joshua. And the Lord rolled away their shame at Gilgal. Well, now he's going to roll away shame again, it seems. So Ehud turns around after sending his servants away at these graven images, and he comes back to the king. He tells the king, hey, I came back because I have a secret message to give you. Makes it sound all hush-hush and clandestine. And well, Eglon probably doesn't suspect Ehud. I mean, after all, Ehud has just brought him a lot of wealth, a lot of riches, and he's still rubbing his hands and gloating over it. And so he has warm feelings toward Ehud, and he doesn't suspect anything. So he hushes him. Shh, if it's a secret message, don't say anything. And then he sends out all his attendants. Oh yeah, you got to tell me the secret message in secret. Verse 20, so Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he arose from his seat. So Ehud meets him in a cooling room. And this is probably for summer heat. You know, when you're a very fat man, the summer heat probably bothers you. You have trouble staying cold as it is. And then being it's summer, it'd be tough. So he has this cooling room that is his own private chamber. And so Ehud comes to him there. And then he tells him, my message is from God. And at this point, Eglon gets out of his chair, which is kind of an accomplishment for a very fat person. Well, why did he get out of his chair at this point? Was he angry to hear that the message was from God? He was thinking it was from one of his servants or something? I don't know, but anyway, the news that it's from God causes him to get out of his chair. Verse 21, then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Now Ehud probably had an unexpected proficiency with his left hand. Everybody would look at his right hand and say, oh, he's crippled. You know, he's not going to be very good at anything, and they wouldn't think about how proficient he might be with his left hand. But he quickly and efficiently pulls this short sword out from his right thigh, the perfect place for drawing by the left hand, and he just as quickly and powerfully thrusts it into Eglon's belly. Now, the fact that he was powerful with his left hand is clear from verse 22. Even the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. So he thrusts this dagger or short sword in so hard that the hilt goes in right after the blade. And so he doesn't draw it out. And of course, Eglon couldn't draw it out because it's embedded inside him. And then his entrails came out, his intestines, it seems to mean, or possibly the contents of his intestines. Nasty. Verse 23, then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. So Ehud leaves through the porch, and he locks the doors of the roof chamber behind him. Now, not knowing the plan of Eglon's chamber, I'm not entirely sure what this means. Does this mean that he locked the front doors of the chamber and went out some back door or some door onto a porch window? Since cooling rooms were usually at the top of the house, does this mean that he kind of climbed down the wall and escaped some back way? Or does it mean that he somehow locked the doors from the inside and then shut them after him? You know, some of our doors are like that. If you don't have a key, you can lock them while they're still open and then close them, and they'll lock behind you. And then he just strode calmly out of the chamber, right past the servants, and walked out. Just boldly walked out the front door. Well, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say whether he escaped out a back way or just marched boldly out the front. And again, not knowing how the locks in his door worked, I'm not sure. But verse 24, when he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. So they said, he is probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. So he leaves, and again, this is what makes me kind of think he might have just walked out the front door, because the slaves see him leave and they come to attend to their master. And they find, surprisingly, the doors are locked. Well, knowing they can only be locked from the inside, they figure Eglon must have locked them themselves, and they say maybe he's relieving himself. And literally in Hebrew, it's maybe he's covering his feet. Now, covering the feet is what you would do when you were going to the bathroom back then, and it meant the second job, if you know what I mean. You would squat down, and squatting, of course, would cause your robe, you'd probably pull it up in the back, but it caused the front of your robe to slump down over your feet. So covering the feet became a metaphor for going to the bathroom, number two, as we put it. So they think, well, that must be what he's doing. He's covering his feet in there. Verse 25. So they waited till they were embarrassed, and still he had not opened the doors of the upper room. Therefore they took the key and opened them, and there was their master fallen dead on the floor. So they wait a long time, figuring he's going to the bathroom. And it becomes embarrassingly long. I mean, what's the matter here? Like we would say, did he fall in? So it's embarrassingly long. And finally they decide, we have to figure out what's going on here. So they fetch a key and they open the door. And what do they find? Well, there's their master falling down dead on the floor. So while they were waiting, thinking he was going to the bathroom, Ehud made his escape. Verse 26. But Ehud had escaped while they delayed, and passed beyond the stone images, and escaped to Sira. So while they delayed, thinking that their master was relieving himself, Ehud made good his escape. And so he went on, he passed by the graven images, and he escaped to Sirath, which means shaggy. Verse 27, and it happened when he arrived, that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. So when Ehud comes to Sirath, he blows a trumpet. And that was a signal to call all the people of Israel together. Now you would say, well, the people in all the villages and towns miles and miles away couldn't hear him blow a trumpet. But it was a signal to send out messengers and gather Israel. So there was probably more than just a trumpet blast. It was probably sending messengers to all different locations to blow a trumpet at all those locations and gather the men together. Together Israel's armies. So the sons of Israel, and son means a representative, so these are to be all the people who came to fight in the army, they came down to join him in Mount Ephraim. Verse 28, then he said to them, follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. So after he has gathered all the Israelites together, he tells them, what is the truth, that the Lord has delivered the Moabites into their power. And that's what into their hand means. When something's in your hand, it's in your power. You can hold it gently, you can throw it, you can try to crush it. It's in your power when it's in your hand. So he said, the Lord has given the Moabites into your power. So they listened and they followed him. Well, he attacked the Moabites and he basically attacked and seized the fords of Jordan. Now, Jordan was a river. It was not easy to cross. So the fords would be the place where people could cross over easily, not get stuck in the mud and so forth. So he holds the fords, the places where they would need to go to get back to their own side of the Jordan, the east side, where the land of Moab was. And he doesn't allow the occupying army to retreat and to cross back to their side of the river. Verse 29. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor. Not a man escaped. So he slays 10,000 men of Moab's army. And it calls them stout. So these were large men. These were not tiny or wimpy men. And they were men of valor. They were valiant men. They were, that means they were strong. They were mighty warriors. And yet he kills 10,000 of them and none escape. So you see, when the Lord was on their side, when the Lord was with Israel, they didn't have to worry about enemy armies. But when they turned from him is when they were conquered and when they were oppressed. Verse 30. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. So again, Moab is subdued, and that was what the judge always did. He conquered the oppressing nation. And so from this point on, Ehud is able to judge Israel in peace. Now it says that they had rest 80 years. But of course, it seems highly unlikely that Ehud judged them 80 years. That would put him, even if he was a young man, put him over 100 years old when his judgeship was over. Well, so this apparently includes Ehud and the next judge, Shamgar. So if we'd guess they had maybe 40 apiece, well, that makes sense from when they're young to when they're old to be a judge. And then after Ehud, we read of the third judge very briefly in verse 31. After him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. So after Ehud comes the third judge, Shamgar. Shamgar means sword, and he was the son of Anath, which means answer. Now we don't read which tribe he's from, but we do read that he delivered Israel from the Philistines. Now the land of the Philistines was actually to the west of Israel, to the southwest, whereas Moab and Ammon were to the east. And the Philistines were one of the nations that Israel left in the land. They hadn't driven them out as they were supposed to do. They weren't one of the nations they were supposed to destroy because they weren't Canaanites. But they were supposed to drive them out, and they didn't. And now they are oppressing Israel. But notice Shamgar's feet. He uses an ox goad. Now an ox goad was a large stick, and it could even be up to 6 inches around. It had a sharp end at one end, which you would use to poke the ox to goad him to move forward while he's plowing. And on the back end, you'd have a shovel. Well, why would you use such a thing as a weapon when a sword or something would be much better? Well, in Judges chapter 5 and verse 8, we read that not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. And this was later under the Philistine oppression. So it seems that the Philistines forbid Israel to have weapons, took all their weapons away. So it could well be that an ox goad was the only thing he had. Now we wonder, he killed 600 Philistines with this ox goad. Does that mean all at one time? Or is that a total over many battles? If it was one time, that's pretty amazing. I mean, imagine trying to beat just 6 men, how tired out you'd be. Or 60. I mean, you'd be totally drained. Imagine trying to kill 600 men. Well, you would need the power of God to be able to do it. But his feat is similar to something that Samson and some of David's mighty men did as well. And of course, it can be done with the power of the Holy Spirit helping him. So he delivered Israel from the Philistines. But the Philistines are going to give them plenty of more trouble, as we'll read later on. Now we have seen that the second judge was Ehud, a man who was crippled in his right hand, and yet who saved them from Eglon, the king of Moab. And the third judge was Shamgar, who won victory with a lowly ox goad. A man with a crippled hand? A man who used an ox goad as a weapon? Such lowly things that God used to save Israel. Well, God often saves through lowly things to show that it's his power and not human ability that does it. Well, that's an important lesson we can learn from the book of Judges.
After another 18 years of servitude, God raises up Israel's second judge, Ehud. God once again brings Israel back to himself by defeating their enemies through this lowly, humble man, Ehud. Between him and the third judge, Shamgar, Israel then enjoys 80 years of peace. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on Ehud, the second judge. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the Book of Judges with Deborah and Barak. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more you study God's Word, the more you can know God. For more information on the program, for past programs, and other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also offer a weekly email newsletter in which Nathan does the same thing he does on this radio program, going verse by verse through the Bible and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on his mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although your donations are always appreciated, you will not be solicited for funds in any way when you write, so feel free to contact us. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.